My name is Jason DeRose. I am the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News, and this is, I've just sort of, you know, humorously called this the listening room rather than the waiting room or the watching room or something like that. So over the next four sessions, we're going to do today, tomorrow, Thursday, all at 5 o'clock, and then Friday at 8 p.m., because exactly what you want to do is listen to a half-hour audio documentary at 8 p.m. on Friday night. But it's a great documentary, so it's called The Gods of Times Square. I highly recommend it. It is my favorite radio documentary ever. I want to talk just a little bit about why I divided these sessions into, three and then the fourth. The first three make sense together. The fourth one is just a great piece of radio. So this one is about place, and then tomorrow's is about character. And the Thursday one is about tension, or you could call it conflict. So I did not invent these categories. I don't know who invented these categories, but Aristotle described these categories in the Poetics when he was talking about drama, that all classical drama has conflict in it, or tension, or plot. It sort of drives the plot. They all involve characters that undergo some kind of change, and they all have a place or setting. The way that I think you probably learned this in the sixth grade is something called setting. So plot, character, and setting. I'm doing these in slightly backwards order because I think that sometimes on the radio, all we hear about is conflict and tension. The pieces that I'm going to play for you later this week that are about conflict, much more subtle conflicts. The best conflicts aren't just sort of one person with one idea against another person with another idea, but multiple levels of conflicts, especially conflicts where people are conflicted within themselves. Those are my favorite stories to tell. Most of the pieces that I'm going to play for you over the next few days, I've edited myself. Some of them I've reported myself. Some of them came into existence long before I was ever working at NPR. I'll try to make that clear, which is which. You'll know which ones I've reported, because you're going to hear my voice, a much younger version of myself. In fact, in some cases, a 20-year younger version of myself. What I'd like to do is play a piece and then spend some time discussing it. The first two pieces I'm going to play are quite short. They're about 3 minutes long, so we could talk about them for maybe 4 or 5 minutes afterwards. And then the third piece that I'm going to play for you is about 15 minutes long, and then we can talk for maybe 10 minutes after that, and then we can go have our picnic. It looks cloudy now, so hopefully it won't be too bright. All of these pieces that I'm going to play for you today are pretty much self-contained, so I don't want to tell you any more about them other than to just pay attention to the setting or the place that they take place, that they are set.
You have heard of bird watching and whale watching, but wolf watching? Well, it turns out an entire industry of tour companies has cropped up outside of Yellowstone National Park. Montana Public Radio's Dan Boyce got the chance to see and hear a wild wolf pack.
The first hints of light are just starting to brighten the morning sky as Nathan Barley and I head into Yellowstone in his black Suburban. We drive winding, snowy roads through the Black Tail Plateau.
It's a great area to find wolves because it's the habitat for their primary prey in the winter, which is elk and bison.
Barley grew up just outside the park, and it's here where wolves killing livestock and big game have created the passionate controversy around these animals. Barley earned his PhD studying wolves, but academia wasn't a good fit. So about 6 years ago, he started a wildlife tour company called The Wild Side.
We've been adding programs to higher volume each year than the year before. I figure this might be a good sighting for us.
We're walking out to a bluff overlooking Slough Creek. Barley directs me to a spotting scope pointing across the valley.
Look through here, you say, I think.
Oh yeah, there's some wolves.
About a dozen, more than a half mile away.
It seems like they already had their breakfast.
That's Englishman Darren Sande.
Yeah.
He and his wife Beverly are here on their first winter tour of the park.
All the wolves up the hedgerows, some were still laying down. Big grey at the top of the hill, fully extended head back, throat back.
And then we hear it.
It's something that you will not hear as a normal day-to-day person.
It's unearthly, it's magical, it's mystical sort of sound.
And it goes through you.
And it seems to bounce off everywhere. So while they're howling, it's like nothing else goes on.
They howl for about 2 minutes. Afterward, we head back to the Suburban. Farley says his typical clients have idealized, romantic notions of wolves. They expect noble creatures that mate for life and kill only what they need.
Well, the reality is, they're top carnivores and predators, and they're effective at being that way because they're these very honed, skilled killing machines.
Nathan Farley's not romantic about wolves. He's respectful, both as a scientist and as a businessman. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Yellowstone National Park.
This is NPR News.
So that piece is just 2 minutes and 45 seconds, but it's one of the first pieces I did with this particular reporter. And I think there used to be this old slogan or something, or marketing campaign that NPR did, which was called NPR Takes You There. And I particularly like this piece because I'm probably never going to get to Yellowstone National Park in the middle of the winter to hear wolves howl, and nor are most of the people who listen to NPR. But we can still take people places that they're never going to go. What are some of your reactions to this piece?
Well, I spent a week there about 10 winters ago listening to the wolves, and actually just drove through, I assume that's the Lamar Valley.
I think so.
And just drove through there about 6 weeks ago. So it brings me right back, and I was trying to think as I listened to it, what if I didn't have those real images? Mm-hmm. I can't separate the two once you do
right.
have them. So.
I just think the pictures are better on the radio. So I prefer hearing it without ever actually seeing it. I'm always disappointed when I see pictures of the people in my stories.
Well, what you miss then is, you know, the bitter cold and the breaking through the ice. And, you know, you miss all of those things by hearing that little story.
Right, true.
And you can keep your images pure.
Right.
I actually raised a wolf hybrid that was my first child.
Oh my.
He outgrew me when he was about 2.5 years old, about 120 pounds. And I had to rehome him to a great big firefighter guy. He wasn't really a dog, but he was 7/8 wolf. I brought him down from Alaska. He was what they call a Mackenzie Husky, which is they take their sled dogs and they keep staking them out when they're in season until they keep breeding until they end up more and more wolf. And it seemed like a really cool thing until the reality set in. He stole my dinner one night when I went to take it back. He snapped at me, and I was like, holy, what else would you like for dinner? So it brings me back to him. He was a great howler,
yeah.
And that was one of the really cool things. He was the smartest animal I've ever had anything to do with. I wouldn't say I owned any. He veritably owned me before it was done. But he was the sharpest little pup in puppy class, as long as he was in tune. As soon as something else caught his interest, he was gone, and there was no getting him back. It was a partnership, but there was no loyalty. And it was something else. I don't recommend it. Can't recommend it. But there's something really cool and really beautiful about them.
I have a very, very un-wolf-like dog, an American Eskimo dog. And he howls only when ambulances and fire trucks go by, because he matches the pitch, though. He's really good at matching pitch. So. Those ones record.
Some of what's happening, like my memory and then Penny's memory, what, no matter what you hear, you relate it to something you know or don't know or read or have some idea about.
I think that's what I mean by the pictures are better on the radio. It's maybe not as precisely what the reporter would have taken a picture of, but it's much more evocative for you because you're associating with all of those things. I think smell is very similar. Like if you smell, there's a very specific smell of my grandmother's house that brings back 1,000 memories.
Yeah.
That's just one smell, and if I smell that particular perfume, Did they all come back?
I feel about two-cycle motor oil that right back to water skiing when I was growing up. I mean, absolutely. This way runs a chainsaw, and I think water skiing.
Well, let me play another short piece for you. And this one also a very strong sense of place. And there's also, I think it's some funny and weird action going on in it, too.
Falconry, the sport of training falcons to hunt game, considered such an important part of human history that it's now included on the UN's list of intangible cultural heritage. The ancient sport is still practiced today. Wyoming Public Radio's Molly Messick spent a day with two longtime falconers and sent us this audio poster.
Rick Sharp and Tom Meckley are standing in a wide-open spot of state land. They're preparing for a hunt with the largest falcon of all, the Jer Falcon. Meckley is tuning in the radio transmitter and receiver system that helps him keep track of his bird. Today, the transmitter is attached to the leg of a gray male called Rex.
Okay. So he's wired up.
Meckley has already let out his dog to start looking for game. In this area, that means Hungarian partridge or sage grouse. Before long, the dog scents a bird, and we stay as still as possible while Meckley lets his falcon fly free.
Once that bird gets in the air, the game realizes that there is a threat there.
Sharp watches as the falcon climbs up and up. All at once, the grouse flies, and Meckley shouts to his bird. Flight is what falconers work for. The falcon plunges from high above, targeting its prey.
And by the look of it, the grouse got grounded.
We're shielding our eyes and squinting out to see the falcon and the grouse silhouetted against the sky. The falcon chased the sage grouse into a small, rocky canyon.
Oh, you look very full.
It's a half an hour later, and the two-pound falcon is perched on top of the dead grouse three times his size.
He's not worried about eating anymore, and he's not so worried about coming home with me, so this is a little dicey right now.
Meckley is stretched out on his stomach in the dirt, trying to lure back his bird. Instead, the falcon flaps its wings and flies off.
Seen a lot of food.
This scene is breathtaking and a little funny, but Meckley is stressed about recovering his bird. Now it's perched on a rock 50 feet away.
He looks sort of proud.
Always very proud.
We do get the falcon back, but it takes a little while. After all, it's a nearly wild bird. Falconry isn't always practiced exactly this way, but for 4,000 years, these basic elements have held true. Part of its appeal lies in witnessing something primal, the response of the prey to the falcon and the falcon to the prey. For NPR News, I'm Molly Messick.
This is NPR News.
So there's another example of taking you to a place that you've probably never been. You know, falconing in, I think she's a couple hours outside of Laramie. What were some of the specific sounds that took you there? Because she doesn't do a ton of description.
And to me, it's the difference between those sort of faraway sounds and the really close-up sounds. Like, you know, when they're sort of whispering, you know, you feel like, okay, I'm really
hunkered
close with this person right now, or there's a reason why. So, and then you have sort of far-off bird calls. So you're like, oh, that's far away.
Right.
It you know, adds dimension to the whole.
Right, and you can hear the flapping, and the flapping starts really loud, but then it gets softer because the bird is flying away. So you've got this image of the bird flying away, although, you know, what you're imagining is probably somewhat different from what actually was seen there.
I wish Scott Slaver were here, because we had a falcon that actually took a chunk out of his head.
Oh, here?
Yeah, I guess it wasn't a falcon, it was a hawk.
Cooper's hawk.
Yeah, it was protecting its nest, and it was definitely aggressive toward people on 10 Mile Trail for a while.
Wow.
Yeah, we actually shut the trail down for a while.
I think hawks are pretty big, though. Like, falcons are actually really, I didn't realize this until this piece, but like a falcon's only like 2 pounds. They're actually fairly small birds.
Yeah, the Cooper's hawk is about a foot tall.
Oh.
So I don't know how that relates weight-wise, but it drew blood on Scott.
Yes. Molly managed to not get injured, but you know, she ran around for hours with this microphone. It's called a shotgun microphone, so it's about a foot or so long, and that's how she mic'd it so well. She just sort of trained it on the Falcon, wherever it was, mm-hmm. and she was able to speak or whisper into it when the Falcon wasn't making sounds.
To me, the funniest part was when she was actually described as something, and she said, he's laying, like sprawled out on the ground, yeah. or whatever that
yeah, is. They're like, they're both sort of on their bellies.
Yeah.
She and the falconer trying to get this bird back. I think this.
It just seems so comical.
It's a really funny image, and she even says this is breathtaking and kind of funny, or yeah. a little bit funny, because they're trying to, like, the hunt was like, only took the beginning, like the hunt took just a few, like half an hour or something. The rest of the day is spent trying to get this bird back. And so they're like chasing it around, trying to feed it little things to get it back.
Just to get a grouse?
No, this was to get the falcon back.
Right, but
to
get a grouse.
Well, you know, this is what a UN intangible cultural heritage
thing. I feel like it'd be a lot easier to like throw a rock at a grouse.
Yeah.
It just seems like a fucking dog, too.
Yeah, the dog was there.
I didn't find it at first.
Yeah, I think the dog, like, helps sense the bird. I didn't either.
Yeah.
I didn't either. I mean, I didn't know that dogs have been domesticated for that long, so. If they've been hunting this way for 4,000 years, they may have been using dogs. I don't know if they've used them the whole time, though. But this story was originally pitched to me as, hey, they're making falconry an intangible cultural heritage at the UN. Do you want a story about that? I mean, that sounds like so boring to me, like having some anthropologist come on and talk about the importance of falconry historically. So I said, just go out hunting with them and tell me this, take me to this place, help me care about falconry in a way that no anthropologist could possibly help me care about falconry. And so that's what she did. Not that I don't love anthropologists. The next piece I want to play is pretty long. It's about 15 minutes long. And I'm going to try to stop it before the audio file is a little longer than the 15 minutes of this documentary. But this is... we have this tradition at NPR of hosts on NPR programs actually going to the street they grew up on to introduce themselves to you as hosts. They go to the street and they tell you a little bit about where they grew up and how they grew up there. At least this used to be our tradition, and I don't think we've done it with some more recent hosts. But this was from a weekend, All Things Considered, about 20 or 21 years ago. It's one of my favorite pieces. It's not my very favorite piece, which will appear on Thursday. This is the woman's voice you're going to hear is Katie Davis. She was the host of Weekend All Things Considered for a couple of years.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and off the street that I've called home since I was 9 years old. I moved just 3 blocks away, nice and close, I thought. Those 3 blocks, though, felt like exile. The new street had an entirely different culture. Actually, there was no culture. And so after 6 weeks, I broke down and moved home to my street. I'm not the only one who is passionate about the street I grew up on. Here's Hester Nelson, who insists on being called Hester the Artist.
When I was younger, I used to want to run away. And my mom, I didn't want to run away for any real particular reason. I can't imagine really wanting to run away from this house. But my mom would say, you know, go run away. And I think behind that was that I really could only run to the end of the street. Because once you got to the end of the street, it was sort of like no man's land. And I think that my mother knew, you know, that I had enough instincts in me, you know. So I would say to people, yeah, you know, I could run away from home, but it would only be down to the gas station and back.
And I guess I have to agree. I can't leave the street. I don't know why I even tried. I have a memory for every sidewalk square, every porch of every row house. I see and talk with people I've known for 25 years. Mrs. Glass, the cat lady, walking her dog. Bob Nelson, the bookseller, who is piling himself into a corner of his basement with stacks of books. Or Pepe Lujan, who still calls me Mono, monkey. Coming up the street from the bus stop, I pass the patch of dirt where we played marbles, flicking them into dusty holes, and the bushes in front of Mr. Austin's building that were the secretest hide-and-seek place. Mr. Austin was a single father with two girls who acted like he was responsible for all of us.
Officer Austin. Yes, indeed. Worked for years at the Hilton.
He was the local pest control guy.
He had great pride in his job. He worked at Naval Surface Weapons. He was the janitor.
He would always walk up and down the streets or chanting these sayings, don't be a fool, stay in school.
Stand tall in your shoes and drift on through.
His car all decorated up.
He used to put these megaphones on the top and wear the sombrero going around, don't be a fool, stay in school. You know, don't be a fool, stay in school. And he was on a mission, I guess. That was his calling.
Everyone on the street had a mission. Mark Raskins was to found a preschool for us. Maddie at the corner store to sell us now and laters. And Woody, the mechanic at the gas station, always kept an eye on us crossing the intersection. Our mission, though, was to play.
Hide and go seek, or you know, dodgeball, I mean, four squares.
Planet of the Apes.
Chase and football.
My first memories are the firehouse, the fire station, and playing at the fire station with the firemen, and playing with a bunch of kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, your brother, Sam Davis, and just being very rambunctious and obnoxious at the fire station and using the fire station as like our playground, our backyard.
For touch football games, we commandeered the middle of the street, in front of the 100-year-old firehouse. My position was tight end, and the boys taught me how to fake a move and then do a button hook. My best friend Erica says her most vivid memory of the street is one of the girls draped in a poncho, spreading her arms wide to the sky, and pulling in a pass for a touchdown. Now, Dean McDonald was always the quarterback.
God, we would have, what, 10 kids out here every day throwing the football. And at one point, the police, I would remember, would come along and take our football. For what reason, I don't know. But we would have several parents to run out the house and yell at the cops and get our football back, you know. Get, fall down, get cut up or banged up, run to the firehouse, be out in 30 seconds. And you're ready to go. You know, as a kid, you heal real fast. But, you know, great comfort knowing that the firehouse is right there, and there were always parents looking out for all the kids, so that was real good.
These football games were the organizing principle of the street, creating an arc to the day. Dusk would find us engrossed in a marathon game, the air sharp in our lungs. Car, someone would yell, and then we'd retreat to the sidelines. And when the traffic moved on by, we'd line up again against each other and play a few more downs.
And I just remember being out here on the street, you know, so my mother called me home for dinner. And then after that, too, if you know, I was able to, which seemed to be all the time. And I can remember playing like hide and seek. And just, you know, all those things that kids did, like running around the block, running in the alley, you know, running in other alleys.
When our mothers did call us in, we'd scatter. Not always ending up at our own tables. Sam would eat at Meg's, Hester at Vicky's, and Dean was just always with us. He moved in with our family in his late teens and stayed a decade. Now married, Dean still lives in our basement apartment.
God, I've practically grown up in your house. Well, I have grown up in your house. And just the wonderful meals that your mom would provide for the whole street, I mean, there wasn't a day that would go by that, you know, people wouldn't stop by, especially at dinner time, you know, which was a wonderful time to stop by here.
So my mom said that Bobby Nelson would call Jimbo
my brother every night and say, so what are you guys having for dinner?
I think we all did that, you know, we would wait and after school and, you know, see what we were doing and what time we had dinner, and we'd all sort of like walk by, knock on the door and see if Jimbo was home, but we knew it was dinner time and my mom never refused any kid or anybody to come in and be welcome at our table.
Hester Nelson remembers her mom's house the same way. That was another thing. I remember people always living with us. Like, this is a fairly big house, but it always seemed like there was room for one extra person, and my mom always found that extra person. It was Annabelle Dion at one point, and then Hester's mom, Barbara Nelson, and my mom, Carol Davis, are the two strong women who anchor the street. They're best friends. And when I asked to interview them both, they said, oh no, we have nothing important to say. So let me say it for them. At a time when many in the inner city shuttered themselves inside or moved out, these women flung their doors open to people needing rooms, to kids. I remember the night Frank Sanchez's mother killed his dad with a gun. Frank and his brother Tony stayed with us, reading comic books all night with my brothers. This communal approach was the philosophy of the street. There were half dozen condos. Now remember, this is 1969 and 1970. The one right next door to us had a red fist on the door, and down the street were the Students for a Democratic Society. We met Rennie Davis and Tom Hayden of the Chicago 7, and the May Day Tribe, which organized the 1971 march to shut down the federal government. Our gang of kids hung around their commune. We gaped at the men and women rearranging social mores, tie-dye t-shirts on the front porch, and for weeks we wore buttons to elementary school, announcing the May Day march. My brother Sam pinned his to his army jacket.
We didn't know what it was all about, or at least I didn't know what it was all about, but you know, you had to go with the crowd, and so we all walked down there. Actually, we walked down there. I remember it was me, I think Bobby Nelson, Jimbo, Katie, Erica.
Babysat that day.
Did you? I don't remember you then. Take that out, scratch that. But I do remember walking towards the Capitol, and I remember getting to a certain point where we were probably about 100 yards from the Capitol, and I remember the line of police that were there in their riot gear, and I remember the tear gas being shot into the crowds, I remember being really afraid because of the hysteria that went on afterwards, and you know, people trying to run away from the tear gas. And I remember my eyes burning, and it was a pretty traumatic, actually, incident for me, because I think I was only 10 years old when it happened. But afterwards, you know, I found out what it was all about, and, you know, it was this awareness of what was going on in the world that I think we started to get in touch with, you know, with Vietnam and, you know, the Black Panther Party, you know, those types of organizations, radical, you know, organizations. I think we were a radical organization within ourselves.
Our next door neighbors, Jean and Nancy Thompson, and their three toe-headed Eagle Scouts, lived right in the middle of all this. They owned the house that the Mayday tribe rented, and they say they were often serenaded through the walls by their tenants singing, "Give me that old-time communism."
They were young. They were, you know, say in their 20s, and very idealistic and so forth.
But well-read.
They had really interesting ideas on all sorts of subjects.
So of course, Leslie Baker was arrested on the roof of the house. And we wake up one morning, oh, that was my big scoop. My scoop for Washington Post was that article with the in-towner. And 3 days later, the Post got it when they arraigned her, but she was arrested as a material witness in the bottom of the Capitol, arrested on the roof of our house. Nancy got on all three.
No, wait a minute, because I always thought she was arrested on the roof of our house.
It was my house that was on the front page of the Post.
I know.
Because at that point, if you remember, we had an FBI agent sitting in front of the house and an FBI agent sitting in the back of the house keeping track on who was in and out of that house next door.
And so no, I don't remember that. I do remember. So they were really staking it out.
Oh, yeah, he sat right there. Remember, 24 hours a day, there was somebody sitting there.
It felt very safe.
And they moved out because they spent all their rent money on bail. Do you remember that?
No,
Remember they were all arrested on that day.
And so then after they moved out, then we got a another, we thought it'd be really nice. There was this lady with a kid, and we thought that'd be really calm. And it turned out that she was working with a non-violent coordinated committee against Vietnam. And of course, then we thought we mentioned the lady with the boy. We tried again, and it turned out to be Russell Means child and mother, you know, from Wounded Knee.
Right.
And while they were here, they were the leaders in trashing the Indian Affairs Committee. And
they took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs, yes.
So then they said, we're going to go with a family. So we got a mother and a father and two kids, right, with our ages. And we thought, this is going to be neat. And so we filled out the application and brought it in. And we upgraded the kitchen, stayed on the floors. You know, we had it really beautiful in there. And he says, we noticed there's a little blank in time there. He says, I just been released from prison. And I'm staying in a halfway house in Mount Pleasant. I want the family near so I can be here in the daytime. He says, I'm one of the Catonsville Nine.
The Catonsville Nine were convicted of pouring blood on draft records in 1967 to protest the war. And so needless to say, the Thompsons rented to George Michie of the Catonsville Nine and became close friends with the couple and their children. The communes on our street folded up in the mid-1970s, and now we have young lawyers and accountants who live in group houses. I often wonder if they know what used to be painted on the walls of their bedrooms, or if the residents of the new apartment complex know that it was built on the grounds of the Appleton Clark Mansion, a huge halfway house for St. Elizabeth's Asylum. If they ever wonder how this street became a community, they can sit for a while on their porch, sit and listen, or talk to the mayor of the street, Dean, or ask Bob Nelson, the king of the porch sitters.
You just, as you sit here and harass people to walk by, you get, it's an incredible blend of people, and all I can think of is something like an omelet, you know, with the onions and all that, and the toppings, and the fancy people, and the real people, and so on and so forth. And to answer your question, I think it's the realness of this neighborhood, and it's all the blending of the spices and the herbs that makes the neighborhood and the street work.
What also works is that we do the blending outside as we call from porch to porch, walk to the corner store together, buy raffle tickets from the kids, or talk with the firemen. We live in the street more than we live on it, not side by side, but together.
So that's Katie Street. This actually started a big project for her that she spent the next two decades working on. I guess she still works on it today. Called Neighborhood Stories, which each of those characters that she introduces you into this piece becomes a whole documentary about that person's life. And so she's been documenting the street she's been in addition to like actually doing work for the past couple of decades. And you can probably find some of those neighborhood stories. You can find many of them have been broadcast on All Things Considered. What did you hear in that documentary?
I liked how it sounded like the first chunk was like all about the kids playing, and it sounded like very like typical like white suburbia. And then it's like, yeah, everybody did that, it's not a big deal. And then she gets into like the history of it and like all the people who live there, and it's like, whoa.
It's not white suburbia, it's actually inner city Washington, D.C.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this it's called Lanier. She didn't want to say the name of the street, but it's Lanier Street in the Adams Morgan neighborhood, and which was, when she was growing up there, quite a dicey neighborhood. Now, as she says, it's much more lawyers and townhouses.
That probably could have been the street that I grew up on, too. My dad built the house when I was, like, 3 years old, and we lived there. He sold it when I was 20, I think.
Are there any specific images that you recall from the story?
It started out by picturing a very small physical space, but then just drew this very large world out of that. Later on. and went from harpsichord music to funk.
Right. I think the harpsichord music was just sort of a bridge between the story that ended right before it and then ended this one. Not quite.
I like the whole image of the firehouse and playing football on the street in front of the firehouse, and if you could skin these or whatever, you could run in there and probably get a band-aid and be back out.
My favorite image in this whole piece is the in the football scene where the young girl in the poncho raises hands to grab the ball. I just love that scene. Mm-hmm. I think about it all. I just think the way that she so quickly and clearly describes it, and we've all seen somebody with a poncho on raise their hands like that.
Yeah.
It's cool, just the accident of geography that this street is, you know, close to the capital, to where they could wander from their innocent playing to get tear gas, to have Russell Means as, you know, downstairs. It happens everywhere, but it just happens to be this, you know, next to one of the most powerful cities on the face of the planet.
Two images for me, the two women being the pillars of the neighborhood and
right,
the safety of everybody watching, because I spent some of my childhood in a neighborhood that was similar to that. I had the Black Panthers and I had all, and it was dangerous. Mm-hmm. So the safety that the people in the neighborhood provided is incredible.
At the same time, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot going on there. There's police action. People are being arrested on rooftops.
Yeah.
FBI guys are staking. Yeah, the FBI front and back of the house.
Police take the football.
Right.
Somebody's mom killed you.
So I mean,
that didn't happen. Like,
it's I like that detail. I mean, she could have told this in a way that sort of made the sort of, you know, the Chicago 7 thing comical, but then she adds this one detail that tells you this is a really troubled neighborhood as well. This isn't all, you know, flowers and meatloaf.
What I liked about it is that a couple memories were wrong, or people had different takes on it, and that's reality.
Yeah.
And I love that, even though it's her story, sort of, mm-hmm. part of it is, well, it's actually all of our stories, and we are creating these memories together, and we're probably off on some of them.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter, because the main point is about community anyways.
Right. Last year when I did this workshop, I played a piece about memory and how memories are formed. It was a combination of a piece about Mrs. Dalloway and a piece about neuroscience. And we actually form memories by telling ourselves stories over and over again. We don't have video camera memories. What we have is our ability to tell the story helps us remember the story. And she does that twice in this piece. There's the part where you were with us on the March on Washington in 71. But then she says, no, I was babysitting that day. And then there's another moment when she's, what is the other moment? They were arrested on the roof of our house. No, they were arrested on the roof. I thought they were arrested on the roof of our house. You know,
on the front page.
Right.
Well, that's right.
Right. Right. But I just love that they're, you know, but as you mentioned, like, they sort of gently correct each other, but it doesn't really matter, like, the precise where exactly which house they were arrested on, or if Katie was there or not, because Katie was in some way there participating in the whole, you know, neighborhood.
I like the universality of being a kid and playing football, and of course, I was thinking of my own kind of memories of that age that I would guess would be, and how when you're that age, it doesn't seem like things will ever change. You can be totally present, and now you know that things will change, and you have to work to be present and enjoy them. But at that time, you don't have to have that like tension of this is going to be different next year. It's just you're totally there, and it will never be any different. And maybe because of that, you're able to retain information a little bit better than when you get older.
Although I like the way that she, you know, the world keeps entering in this particularly, you know, pertinent way. Between all of these protest groups going on. This is actually a really fun little coincidence. Happens to be that the day of that March 1971 happens to also be the very first day that All Things Considered went on the air, and there's this great half hour that we produced that day about what happened in Washington, D.C. I did not bring it with me, but next year I'll bring it with me. Here it then.
I find that in listening to it, there are little pieces that bring me back to when I was growing up. I almost like had a physical reaction when they said they were playing in the street, and then somebody would yell car, and then they'd all step to the side and then go back, and that happened so many times to us when we were playing in the street. It's just like everywhere kids do that, you know. And then and then the continuing the discussion about Vietnam or SES or all of those political things that happened, you know, not part of my personal history, but happened, and I remember experiencing that. Just hearing it, you know, it's like, it's my story too, but my childhood wasn't like their childhood particularly.
Right. Any thoughts that people have about this piece?
Well, one more thing that crossed my mind was, how could I use a piece like this in one of my classes where I say, okay, because it would have dual purposes. Number one, in autoethnography, learning about research methods, blah, 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 blah. But also to kind of get discussions going about Russell Means,
right,
and
right.
Black Panthers and all those kinds of...
Right, you could play this for a class and have them just like write down the name, the proper names that they hear of people, and say, now you have to do your job to research Russell Means, or who were the Chicago Seven, and that can be.
And the other
nine
was a nine.
I'm sorry.
There's some sort of Chicago Seven and somebody nine.
Yeah, the Claytonsville Nine.
There you go.
The ones who poured blood on the draft records.
Yeah.
There just don't get names anymore like that.
Yeah.
Six. Or, you know,
six.
Yeah,
that's true, man.
The Holden 10.
It was interesting. I mean, she set this all up, but there were like four words that got me interested in one character, but it was because she set it all up. She said the cat lady walking her dog.
Yes, is that great?
Yeah.
I wonder if she did a story on that. But it was just because you knew this, the quirkiness, and you knew about the whole, how did they treat her, how did she treat them.
Right. There's sort of one of the people she ends up profiling eventually for the series was Hester the Artist, because you kind of want to find out, why is she called Hester the Artist?
Yeah.
Or the King of the Porch Sitters, or the Mayor of the Street. Those are all characters she goes on to tell stories about later.
And I liked her description of the young communists, you know, like just real passionate, but they're really well read, you know.
Right.
You know?
I love that moment when she says, I often wonder about the young lawyers who now live on this street, knowing what used to be painted on those walls.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the time you just paint over the walls, and so like all of that's still there.
The history's there.
Yeah, it's all there, you just can't see it. Well, we've got like 3 minutes left, and I just happened to, as I was reviewing this last night, this happened to also be the last day Katie Davis hosted Weekend All Things Considered, and I wanted to play you just the last couple of minutes of her hosting, because she read this, well, I'll just say Walt Whitman does a much better job than Paul's Letter to the Romans did last night in making the point, because Walt Whitman is a much better writer than Paul.
One last note. I'm going on to other assignments now here at NPR, so this is my last day with Weekend All Things Considered. I have loved speaking to you, and sometimes with you, this last year and a half. And I will carry the time with me. And since we embrace poetry on this show, here are some words from Walt Whitman. This is what you should do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss what insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem.
So that's it for tonight. Tomorrow we'll do character and... Actually, tomorrow is the most Lutheran night of this whole thing, because I have two of the pieces happen to involve Lutherans. We'll talk about character related to interfaith marriage, or when one partner in a marriage is religious and the other is an atheist. A profile of a tattooed Lutheran pastor you may have heard of, and then a story about caregiving for a child with a severe cerebral palsy. So that's tomorrow afternoon.
Cool.
See you then.